This is Rafflebix After Hours.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Rack Addicts After Hours, of course, episode 92. You've got Ben and you've got Pete in your ears this morning, afternoon, evening, whatever time you choose to listen to your podcasts. I don't really know. But here we are. And I come to you fresh from the world of bicycles and more specifically the miserable array of differing standards for component compatibilities and such. We get questions, or I got questions, and we, certainly you, have had questions in the shop, I'm sure, Pete, of, will this work with this? What sort of this do I need to connect these things together? And what are the worst situations? Maybe getting the right combination of balanced and unbalanced cables. Maybe some software stuff, you know, when you might need this version of Windows to run that software.
Yeah,
that's kind of it in our
more
field.
Will this hardware talk to this piece of IT in this
most
manner,
of the time,
that type of thing?
Yeah, it's normally computer centric when compatibility is a question, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm always worried when it kind of creeps into IT support, because that's not really what we're here for.
No, and you get the customer who goes, oh, actually, I'm in town next week, can I bring my laptop in, can you install it for me? I've done that a couple of times, that wasn't fun. But anyway, it's so much worse in the world of bicycles, and there is a project with my bicycle that I'm working on, and I've come across loads of them. For example, the bit where the pedals go, the axle that they spin around, that area of a bike is the bottom bracket, and there are different solutions for attaching bearings in there. Plenty of diameters and widths and thread depths and all these kind of things. It's just horrifying. So, the project in question is to remove the gears on the front and just rely on gears at the back. Modern mountain bike stuff means you can have a really wide range of gears to get you up miserably steep hills and reasonably fast on the flat. And it does involve cross compatibility and contamination with the road cycling and the mountain bike world, and it's quite fun to think about. But I've come across so many, oh no, this needs a different diameter spindle to be compatible with this set of it's horrifying. Thankfully, Anthony from the ModCaf is also a cycly man, ran a bike shop for a good time, and he's been a hero in helping me out with all this kind of stuff. So Anthony, if you're listening, thank you very much. But that's what I've been doing, and that's actually been where my money's been going. Not synthesizers. I won an eBay bid for the first time in probably forever, which is very exciting.
I hate bidding. I going for the buy now. You know where you stand.
Yeah, that was what I always did, because I had been burned and disappointed so many times, but I did manage to get myself a screamer of a deal on some brake levers and brakes. Happy Ben.
New, secondhand? What was
secondhand, yes. Not very heavily used at all, but required to get the gearing in question happening.
So going back to what you were saying about standardisation, I thought most things on bicycles these days were relatively standard. I mean,
no.
So what typically isn't?
All of it.
Really?
Yeah, it's bad. So where to start? And I'm absolutely no expert in this field whatsoever. So older bikes, I couldn't give you a date range, but in the handlebar area, let's start there. There will be a number of different diameters for the actual handlebars themselves. This is sort of vintage and modern kind of bits. They're not necessarily interchangeable. The handlebar area generally is kind of fine, but the various combinations of gearing are where it gets pretty nasty. For example, let's say you bought a nice bike. Like I did. I bought a nice bike. It cost about £1,000. And you say, okay, it came with some entry-level gearing type stuff. So all the cogs, they're not especially durable. They wear kind of fast. And it's only got 9 speeds on the back, 2 on the front. If you say, okay, say you want more gears or you just want to get up hills a bit easier, you can say, okay, I want to add that functionality. What you'd have to do is change the cogs on the back, the derailleur, so the mechanism that moves the gears at the back. You'd likely also have to change something up the kind of the front half, because if you want more gears at the back, that will kind of limit the capacity of one of the derailleurs for some reason, so you'd also have to change your gearing up the front. You'd definitely have to change the shifting device, and on a road bike, that also means changing your brake levers, and it ends up being a case where actually just buy a new bike with the specs that you want.
You're not going to have to do that. I mean, your bike wasn't necessarily that cheap. It's quite a specialist bike as well, isn't it?
Yeah, but that's the situation I'm in. If I wanted to change the gearing, you have to replace practically everything. It's a nightmare.
Yeah, I can see that. You need to sort of maintain ratios and so forth. It makes sense when you spell it out like that.
Yeah, it's a minefield. And it's one thing when you start modular and you go, oh wow, so I need a case, I need a power supply, and I need modules. What modules do I get? That, for me, when I first was interested in modular, I overcame that in about an evening of YouTube and interneting about, mostly, to a certain extent. It'd be impossible to do that with bikes, because there's so many
combinations and options and so forth.
Yeah, and spanning so much longer than modular's sort of been around in its current modern form.
I suppose so. It depends. I mean, I know that there's a fraternity that like to have classic, what they describe as classic push bikes, because I had a discussion with a gentleman in the store a few years ago, and he was telling me all about it. It seems to be a world within worlds.
Definitely. So steel being an early, common, cheap, strong, reliable material, because the tubes are so much skinnier than a modern carbon bike, there's that kind of classic look about them, which I also quite like. But yeah, there's definitely a subculture for everything in the cycling world. It's mad.
You think it was just about getting on the road and cycling?
I think it's like anything. If you have a hobby that starts with getting on the road and pedaling your bike around, you then get a bit too far onto the internet and the technical buying things and tinkering side of the hobby begins.
Oh, the internet is responsible for so much in that respect.
So much money spent, so much time potentially wasted. But there we are. It's been what I've been doing. Pete, tell us about your week.
Well, mainly a particular item, which I've been waiting for since May, I want to say.
Can you tell what it is, listeners?
Has arrived, and unfortunately, it's mostly going to depart very quickly.
Let me reenact what happened when I walked into Pete's house, and he said, "Ooh, buyer's remorse," and then I accidentally peeked into the room where we do the podcast, and I saw it sitting there. I went, "No, Pete, no, why? Oh, what happened?"
The synthesizer, which I ordered in May, has arrived, and unfortunately, it's turned out to be not at all what I expected.
Would you go so far as to say hot garbage, as some people
No, it's a difficult thing. So basically, I ordered a Arturia Polybrute at the beginning of May this year.
Delicious, or so we thought.
Yes, I had watched many videos, and I had gleaned that it was a fabulous piece of equipment. And in some respects it is, but in other departments it really has been a complete letdown.
Well, let's focus on the good. Let's not be too English about it for the whole podcast. It's built really well.
It's built fantastically well. The quality of the construction, as always with Arturia, is first rate. It's built like a tank.
And it looks great, if you like that styling, but we do.
Yes, I mean, yes, again, it looks great. And that was all part of the appeal. I thought, well, look at it. It must be great.
Yeah.
I mean, even when it lights up, it's got a wonderful black and white OLED screen.
Oh, yeah, that animation.
And it does this fantastic animation. It just looks really great.
Easy to use.
Yeah, it's very intuitive. I mean, extremely intuitive, I would say. There's a little bit of menu diving, but very minimal. Most of the controls are physical on the control surface. But the problem being,
where it fell down,
is the tonal range, let's put it that way.
Yes.
It's incredibly limited. All I can describe it as, I'm completely gutted.
I mean, I think it's getting worryingly close to how much you kind of rant about the Poly D, to be honest. But it's a different kind of ranting.
Yes.
the emotions were strong.
It's not the sort of the Poly D where it's sort of a shocking design and hideous sound. It's, as I say, the tonal range appears to be really limited. A machine that has so many modulation possibilities, a wonderful effects section, but the primary analog synth part of it was, for me personally, a complete letdown.
Yeah, when I met it, I was fiddling about a little bit, and then I realised, oh wait, they've left out the good bits, all of the good bits about the Brute oscillators, the Ultrasaw and the Metalizer. It just wasn't there. All you were left with was the Brute factor on the filter, which is frankly much less interesting.
I mean, obviously, one thing that most people do when they get a new synth or play with a synth for the first time is you go through the presets.
Yeah.
And what became evident really quickly was that once you'd heard a selection of what it can do, so it can do a string sort of type sound, it can do an organ type of sound, it can do a bass, a very good bass.
It's got a couple of e-piano keys style things.
Yes, but once you've heard those, that is pretty much what it can do. And as you go through all the presets, there's a distinct feeling of deja vu because there is just not much range. I mean, other synths have got quite an extreme range of abilities tonally. They can move. I mean, it can do kind of somewhat ethereal, and it can go to the other extreme and be really powerful and bassy. But for me, there was a certain type of harshness which was difficult to get rid of, and it was a bit too fizzy, if you get my point.
I know
it's
the fizzy.
A sort of fizzy quality to the output. And most of the interesting factors to any of the patches were only added by the extreme amounts of modulation and the effects processor. Yeah. The actual core synth was very disappointing.
Who would have thought?
I know. I had quite a bit of anticipation. I'd heard and watched so many reviews from leading respected YouTuber reviewers of this type of equipment. And by all accounts, it was a fantastic synth. I remember Mylar Melodies suggesting that it might have been one of the most significant polysynths to be released in recent history. There was a very good review from Nick Batt on Sonic State and many other commentators, but for me, unfortunately, and this is a first, I fear it's going to have to go back. I have never returned a synth in my life because I was unhappy with how it performed, but unfortunately, yes, I'm afraid this one is going to go back. I am going to return it.
I mean, I'm as shocked as you are, listeners.
I am completely, as I said earlier, gutted. I really am. I had so many high hopes for this. I knew that it was going to be tonally different, and it is. But for me personally, there wasn't anything there that I can actually use in the type of productions and the work that I do. It didn't do anything for me at all. I tried. I've spent an extensive amount of time over the last 24 hours with the machine. I've gone through all the patches. I've tried to build patches from the first initialized states, and with no success. I couldn't find any hidden gems. I couldn't pull anything out of it. I didn't find anything that inspired me. And if a synth doesn't inspire you, what's the point?
Yeah, definitely nothing. No point at all. So Summit, for you, is absolutely just the one.
Well, the Summit.
Compared to this, anyway.
Compared to this and many of the others. All the Dave Smiths I have. Even the Prologue, which previously was somewhat of a disappointment in some respects when I got it home, but it still had some patches that distinctly were usable. It had certain qualities that I could utilise.
Mm.
And unfortunately, with the Polybrute, there is literally nothing I personally can use it for. And as it's quite an expensive synthesizer, I can't afford to have a unit like this effectively redundant in my studio. So it's going to go back. I'm considering a couple of other different makes and models.
Do tell.
Previous to that, I was going to buy the Moog Matriarch.
In
hindsight, I wish I had. I mean, still intend to get one, but I wish I had ordered that in preference to this. I also possibly have a hankering for a UDO.
Mm, I mean, they are nice.
They are nice. It's still a machine with not a wide spectrum of capabilities as such, but it's got more potential, much more potential.
And it does have a slightly more interesting calling card than the Polybrute, given that binaural and interesting hybrid architecture.
Yeah, so, I mean, the Polybrute is only six voices. So I'm not sure where it goes when it, because it's also capable of layering, but I don't know where you stand when you do layer it. I'm not sure if are they using the same technique where it's got more potential voices. You only get six, or it's doing voice stealing.
I wouldn't know how it works, but I guess you just halve your voice count and then it will start stealing, won't it?
Yeah. So are we saying that it only gives you, it's only three note polyphony when you've got a stacked,
what, on the Polybrute?
Yes,
I assume so.
Aside that, there wasn't many layered sounds in there anyway. There's a few patches. I mean, it does do bass very well. I mean, it's got that brutish sound, and it does, if you want the sort of your wobble basses or, you know, that type of thing, it does aggressive. It does some very strange, quirky sci-fi stuff. It's literally in the name, it's very brutish and gritty, but not necessarily in the good way. It's not like there's something like the OB6 where it's got this kind of gritty sound to it, but it's a really nice grit. It's to my ears, it's a very discordant, gritty sound.
I think it's probably in that middle ground of it's not the pleasant OB6 grit and it's not the completely outlandish, really gritty Matrix Brute thing.
Yeah, I think I would actually have been better off with a Matrix Brute because you know where you are. Is it duophonic or is it just monophonic? I can't remember.
You can do three notes through the same filter.
Yeah, so I think a Matrix Brute would have been a better option, to be honest. Mm. It's not, and again, this is only my opinion, but it's not a great polysynth. It does unison well, it does monophonic well, but it doesn't do polyphony the way I want polyphony to happen. It doesn't, as I say, when you want it to be really soft and you use a filter to try and flatten it out, it goes too muted. And if you open up the filter, it just becomes too bright and too fizzy. Yeah, I'm seriously disappointed.
A swing and a miss for Arturia. Speaking of Arturia swinging and missing, did you see that they've introduced a new interface? The Mini Fuse.
No, I hadn't seen that.
Well, they're delightfully uninteresting. Think your Focusrite 2i2 kind of flavours. They have a USB hub on the back.
Okay.
And that's probably the most interesting thing that you've got. I'm on Synthtopia here, and some of the commenters have tickled me quite a bit. Somebody called Zagreus. Ooh, it's like Hades, the video game I was talking about last week. Zagreus says, Arturia hardware is the epitome of hit and miss. And then Gaddy says... this is a quote pretending to be from the Arturia bods. After the complete failure of Audio Fuse, we knew we would need to deliver a more affordable audio interface to grab some cash from the entry-level market. And that's what the Mini Fuse is for. Thoroughly uninteresting.
Fair enough.
I like giving our listeners thoroughly uninteresting news. It cracks me up. I hope it doesn't bore you. That's kind of it in the synth world.
Well, other than that, I have finished my M185 sequencer.
Oh, nice. Is it worked?
Is it installed? It worked straight away.
Lovely.
I was quite pleased. It was a pretty straightforward build, although, it's not potentially a kit for beginners, but it went together nicely. And it works really well. There wasn't any
excellent
calibration needed, which is always good. That's always fun and games if you've got to sort of
definitely
fiddle around with a meter or something like that and try and get stuff within parameters. It seems to work straight away. It doesn't need external clocking, which was
nice.
Good. It doesn't have a BPM kind of readout, so
no.
You don't know what speed it is. So if you need to clock it precisely, you would have to use some sort of external clock or feed it into something else, if there is something else that would actually tell you what BPM it's actually running. But I think
maybe
I think the external clock most probably is your only route. It works really well. It's not quite like the Metropolis.
Yes, I was going to ask you about the comparison, because Metropolis is faders for your notes, whereas M185
Yeah, it's got rotary potentiometers.
Exactly. And there's more gate modes on the latter, aren't there? Because you have 8 position switches rather than 4 for the gate modes, because it's two... Am I making this up?
Yeah, it's much more literal. It's not, because it's sort of done in logic on the Metropolis, where you select various things. And I don't think it's got all the different modes.
Sort of the pendulum and stuff, because there's quite a few on the Metropolis and there's only, 4 on here?
Yeah. So it's a bit stripped back, but what I like about it, it doesn't, it stays the way you left it switched off.
Oh, nice. That's cool.
Because it's all physical switches. It's not as if you, with the Metropolis, you set certain things up and then it loses it once it's powered off.
Right. You have 2 8-way switches per step, so you've got more gate modes essentially. So the first one would be all rests, next one play the first, rest the rest. Third will be play everyone. Next one is alternating. After that it will appear to be play one skip two. Next one down, first and last. One after that is random, probably. And that last one might be sustain, I think. What do you know?
I've had a bit of a fiddle, but I've been sort of distracted with other things. I've been trying to get myself prepared for the modular CAF performance.
I'm excited. Day after my birthday, that one. So this one, because it's quite big, I guess that will be in the full 2-row system once you've...
I think it will. And as I say, I'd better set it up and just, I know when I switch it on, it will be doing the same thing. It won't be having to re-sort of jig it and get it ready. I mean, obviously, the new version of the Metropolis has memories, mm-hmm. so you can recall stuff. But yes, I'm primarily just pleased that it worked. I mean, after my disaster
after
with
the Faco, yeah.
Yes, I mean, I really need to tackle that again and have a serious think about it. But it's just the way the tightness of the hex mix.
Oh, trying how to get, dense it is,
and it's one of the inner channels that it's working on, and you've got to get between all the potentiometers and so forth. So,
tricky one.
Yeah, I'm not looking forward to that.
Of course, you mentioned now you've put it down for a considerable time, you're going to have to do all the legwork to remember where everything is and understand the schematics again.
That's the problem. I mean, I had a few pointers from Befaco, because I did write to them and said, look, I know that, you know, there's no guarantees with this stuff with kits, but what do you think? And they kind of said, it sounds like no power's going to the leg of this particular chip,
yeah,
and try that. But I'll have to really get my head around it. As you say, you really sort of get my mind melded with the all the information. And
become one with the schematic.
Yes. My other little issue is that I've got to get, because I had a really nice thing going, as you remember, with the various modules when it was in the big case, and then I promptly de-wired it to move it into the other case, but didn't take note of how it was all plugged.
Oh, what, the when you had it in the little skiff?
Yeah.
Ah.
So, I mean, Pete,
that's a rookie mistake.
I know, and especially when everything's black. There's no colour coding, so black modules, black cables.
Oh, dear.
I might get some white cables, actually, and just have them as, you know, so white cables will be audio or something like that, you know, so there's some segregation. Because what it might end up being is that I start off with a particular configuration and then just start adding patch leads during the performance.
Oh, yeah.
Which is not exactly how I was planning for it. I was planning that I would have it all ready to go and then cycle it through some various different things by just tweaking some knobs and pushing some sliders and so forth. But I might do it in a different way that as the performance goes, I add another patch lead and it sort of morphs it that way. We'll have to see. I mean, it will be a thing. Something will happen and people will hear something.
Awesome. And listeners, of course, you will be able to hear the result on SoundCloud whenever I get up off my backside and edit the stuff that is currently in my quite considerable backlog of ModCaf stuff that I need to process. I'm sorry, I don't have the energy.
I've ordered from Amazon some appropriate audio cables that will go eventually through several adapters from 3.5mm mono eventually to male XLRs.
What have we got? We'll be back in the Westie, so we'll have DI boxes, so you can go just mono 3.5 to mono 1/4 inch if you want.
Okay.
Two of those, that would work best.
I think possibly I'll have that as well, because I had to buy two adapters to get to that end result, but I might have gone stereo. Okay. I'm sure I can
back at your soldering.
Or just order some more cables. You can never have enough weird and wonderful kind of adapters and cables for every event.
Definitely.
Or every situation that may occur.
Yes, indeed.
Quite a busy week in that respect. Very disappointing in the respect of the Polybrute. I shall be returning that tomorrow and sort of coming back to lick my wounds.
Just cuddle with your Summit. Pretend
yeah, I mean,
never
I
happened.
Really should get the Summit's been living in its new flight case for the last several weeks, so I really should establish that back into the studio now.
Yeah, get it out. Get
Having
it
said
sunshine.
That, I really need to get the Poly Evolver out. That's been in its flight case for possibly a year now.
What, since the last ModCaf that you brought it to?
Why, possibly. It was the Summit displaced its position in the studio because there's only so many synths I can have installed at any one time.
Well, that's more cause to get your rear in gear and move the studio into the room we're in now.
Yes, it's about three times the size. And then a bit like having a modular case, there'll be gaps and I'll have to fill it with synths.
Well, maybe not too much of a gap, because we can then start doing some treatment and turn this into a more professional Rack Addicts podcast studio.
Yeah, it does need some sound conditioning. It's not awful, but you know, when I edit these podcasts, there is a certain amount of slap coming off the walls.
Yeah, and well, I think we do need to do that together, because I need to make some for me as well.
Got the workshop, got all the tools.
It'd be so much easier than me faffing around outside my flat trying to saw something.
No, we can do it. We can do it. We can do it indoors, heated.
Wonderful.
And we could almost. I mean, in fact, I saw a video of how a small professional company who makes sound panels, how they did it, and they just had a really basic kind of jig that they had laid out on the table, which allowed them to get strips of wood which were exactly the same width as the rock wall.
Oh, nice.
And then fit them together in a perfect oblong and then secure them, then fit the rock wall and then stretch your chosen material covering over it.
Yeah.
And it makes for a very quick process, so we could actually make quite a few of them. Nice. We talked about it quite some time ago. We were talking about going halves on a big
load of rock wool.
Yeah, because it tends to come in great big bundles from your local DIY.
Yes, indeed. I think the only unknown for that at the moment, we just need to pick or find somewhere for a suitable fabric, because you can easily cut it to size and just staple gun it to the back, but you've got to pick your fabric first, haven't you?
Well, don't they go for a sort of a trendy kind of Hessian
that's the thing,
dyed type of thing? I'm sure it'd be relatively easy to get hold of.
Yeah, for me it needs to be other half friendly in terms of aesthetics at least. So,
well, I mean, there's always a general choice of colour, so you could take some swatches home and get approval, couldn't you?
It's like buying a new carpet. What an adventure.
Don't tell me about that. Buying a carpet to match a carpet you already bought from the same retailer, and they explain about batches in carpets. So
joyous.
Even if it's the same make of carpet and it's the same supposedly colour, if it's not the same batch, it could be quite dramatically different to your original one.
Yeah, in that case, there's not going to be a round two of making more acoustic treatment, that's for sure.
Yeah, I've learned that over the year. That goes for all sorts of things, including wallpaper, anything. Yeah. That's quite strange how much inconsistency there is. I mean, floor, wall tiles, same sort of thing, ceramic tiles. Mm. Yes, I've experienced that so many times. It's not the same colour. Yeah, we could do that. As I say, I am getting to start clearing the workshop. I can actually see the table saw now.
Oh, nice.
It became a sort of temporary table. Unfortunately, around here, in most situations, any flat surface becomes a storage area.
Yeah. I do have a little bit more vaguely tangential to Arturia. There is a new source for you to get your fixings of Mylar melodies. There is a new Gear for Music-based synth tech channel thing. It's called Gear for Music Synths and Tech. There's two videos on there at the moment, one of which has the Mylar hands and voice demonstrating the Cherry Audio Mercury 4 Synth-E Mosizior for the computer.
Didn't he do some stuff for Sound on Sound at one stage on there for modular back in the day?
Not sure if it was Sound on Sound, but definitely Future Music.
Okay, that's what I'm thinking of.
Both DivKid and Mylar Melodies have done. I don't think they still do, potentially.
No, I haven't seen any recently, to be honest.
No, used to be at sort of Source Distribution, which is why I did a bunch of the Arturia stuff. No idea if he's still there or not, but there we are. Potentially more Mylar Melodies action in the future.
Yeah, it's strange how, well, not strange, it's logical to think how many of the leading YouTubers who are involved in reviewing and commenting on music hardware tend to work for either retailers, spooky that, or distributors, certainly in the business in some shape or form. But I suppose that's where you're going to get that type of knowledge. You've got to be quite heavily engrossed and be exposed to this stuff. Your average man on the street potentially wouldn't get the opportunity to get their hands on that much equipment.
It's true. You've got to have that easy source to start out. Again, I didn't. I just bought it and reviewed everything I bought. Well, not reviewed,
that's a start.
I demoed it.
but there's always a finite level to that, isn't it? You're
going
to run out of stuff quite soon, unless you've got deep pockets.
Or you very quickly get lucky and manage to have that self-sustaining use YouTube funds to buy stuff.
Yeah, that situation would be nice. It's a bit like some of the car people I follow. They've actually got enough momentum that they can keep buying more and more exotic cars on the back of the amount of money and any sponsorship or even other funding that they get, and it sustains them. That typically seems to be more in the USA for some reason.
Yeah, well, thanks to the generosity of Bifaco and also embedding my videos on their website, my Crush Delay V3 video has 7,900 views. Thanks to Noise Engineering, my Manus Iteritas video has 14,000 views. And
that's reasonably healthy.
It's pretty good, yeah. My Bifaco Spring Reverb one has 10,000 views. It's not too bad. And interestingly, the most viewed video I made is entitled "Deadmau5 Riffs on a Korg Monologue." So, of course, as Deadmau5 in the title, it has 50,000 views.
That's a bit of a clickbait there.
Not intentionally, really, because I was just playing a couple of his songs, didn't think about it, and it's just...
How do you stand legally by even mentioning his name? Is that?
I don't think
I
stand.
Did you spell it with the 5 at the end?
Yes, I did. Although I put a capital D, and I'm not sure if there is a capital D. It might just be a lowercase.
I really can't remember.
I don't know. I'm not even sure that I care. But there we are. Some YouTube-y stuff. Disappointingly, because This is quite annoying. I uploaded, to support releasing the EP, I uploaded a video of playing my EP on cassette with the tapiness through the cassette player that you so kindly have lent me.
Well, you can keep it.
Very kind of you. It copyright striked my own video on behalf of myself automatically. So none of my subscribers saw it come up in their subscription feed.
That is quite a common thing. I've heard of it so many times, people getting strikes on their own music. You've just got to make sure that your actual YouTube channel is whitelisted against your
it
publisher.
May well be now, because I flagged it obviously through YouTube and things, but I think I then went through CD Baby's stuff to try and get it all linked up, and I think it is. So I could delete it and try again, but I honestly don't care.
I certainly had that experience with a video interview that I did with one of the gentlemen running London Modular.
Oh yeah.
And we went along and interviewed him in the store, and it was a great interview. And on departure, he suggested that we use some of their music and sent me a link to it. And I consequently used it in the video and got struck on it.
Yeah, nightmare.
And I thought, great, that's just what I wanted.
What can you do? Ooh, here's an interesting thing that I caught on the internet. I may well have mentioned a favourite YouTube channel once before, probably in a much earlier miscellaneous multimedia recommendation. James Hoffman, does that ring a bell?
Not especially.
Ah, well, this is the crazy coffee dude on the internet who we really like. He reviews grinders, and I've spoken before about the ridiculous expense of grinders. This one, I mean, you'll be familiar with hand grinders, of course, just a manually rotating instead of having a motor attached. He recently reviewed one from Weber Workshops, which is actually a couple of ex-Apple people, Apple engineers. It's called the Weber HG2. So it's a table-mounted hand grinder with kind of a vertical flywheel. So it's this kind of scale, you know, relatively big thing. Guess the price for me.
I suspect I've got to go super high.
We're working in dollars.
I know what I want to say, but I'm going to be reasonably conservative and say $600.
Oh, if only. $1,650.
I was short by 1,000.
for a hand grinder.
What's so special about this hand grinder?
It's got a gearbox in it.
Mm-hmm.
When you have dark roasted coffee, it offers much less resistance to the grinding because it's much more brittle and kind of...
crumblier.
Crumblier. So you've got a setting for, you know, going faster through that, or another easier setting for your light roast coffee, which is what we in the filtery third wave coffee world seem to like. So it's got a gearbox. It's got something they call the magic tumbler, which is what the coffee grounds collect in, which does have some pretty interesting declumping distribution-y stuff in it. It's got a brush in it integrated into a handle.
What, you sort of kind of pluck it out and give it a little brush over?
Yeah, just to get rid of all the grounds that have kind of collected. The main thing will just be the small batch numbers, really high precision CNC aluminium and steel type situation. That's where the money goes, really.
It just seems a bit over the top price wise. I know that a lot of this coffee paraphernalia is expensive, but that's
Thankfully it still, I think, falls short of some of the snake oily hi-fi world stuff.
Yeah, some of that is ridiculous. I remember seeing a YouTube video where they were demonstrating a $2 million hi-fi. I know.
Yeah. And oh, there's those HDMI cables. I want to read some of the bump on those HDMI cables because it's really funny.
But surely HDMI is a digital format.
Yeah, so it's even funnier.
And it doesn't really matter that much to the best part that what they're made of. You don't have to be gold plated or anything like that.
Nope. Here we go. Okay, so this was actually from, there's a Linus Tech Tips video from 2016 about this, just because it's hilarious. But some of the marketing bump is really fun to read. Listeners, I don't know if this is a legitimate website or not, but it's called futureshop.co.uk. Their tagline is connecting you with AV excellence. Ooh, they've got numbers. Let's see where they're based, if they're based somewhere. Somewhere in Hertfordshire. Yeah, anyway. So, this listing is even better than that HDMI cable. This is the Wireworld Platinum Starlight 7 USB Type A to B connector. I'm going to read all the stuff and then you can guess your price, okay, Pete? So, you get a lifetime warranty, so don't worry. You have a couple of drop-downs for the options on this product, one of which is the only length that you can buy it in, which is 1.5 meters. Above that, you have another drop-down for your options. You can have 24 to 96 hours of burn-in time.
What?
on a USB A to B cable. Does this add cost to it? No, it doesn't, thankfully, because futureshop.co.uk know full well that they're not going to do anything with it. Okay, let's get to some of the bump.
How would you know anyway?
I know. Who knows at all? So, the Platinum Starlight 7 USB audio cable is intended for the most discerning listeners and advanced audio systems, where its ability to reveal the natural timbre of acoustic instruments and voices is invaluable.
Well, hold on a minute. What are they passing over? I mean, they're passing digital information over.
The Platinum Starlight 7 employs the Wireworld's new patent-pending six-conductor DNA helix, which uses six signal conductors, twice as many as other USB cables.
Am I supposed to price this up now?
Oh wait, there might be a bit more
bump on it, a bit more...
Whoa, there's a lot of it.
Well, if it's really expensive, they're going to have to justify it with lots of words.
Okay, there's obviously some fake reviews, because who on earth would buy this? Okay, it's not quite like the whiskey world, where they're breathlessly searching for more strange metaphors and flowery language, but it's still stupid. Ooh, are they claiming that they reduce jitter? Anyway, stick your price on it, Pete. What do you reckon?
Oh, again, I'm going to be relatively conservative. 50 big ones.
You're a long way off. It does have what appears to be carbon fibre on the connectors.
Okay.
On the housing-y bit with the Wireworld logo.
So what's the benefit of that?
It looks cool.
Yeah, but it's around the back somewhere. You won't see it.
It's not mentioned in the bump, so I don't know. Ooh, it features CompoSilex 2 insulation technology, which minimises triboelectric noise produced by conventional insulation materials.
I'm enthralled.
Here we go. It's on sale, thankfully.
Okay.
So it's only £712.
What?
Instead of £830. But don't worry, because obviously as a business owner, you can claim the VAT back. £593 ex-VAT. Love it. Bargain.
Is it a joke?
I've no idea. I mean, it appears you can buy it, and it is on sale.
And what do we sell USB cables in the shop? Aren't they... £2.99?
Something like that, yeah. Will it perform exactly the same as this one? Yes.
I mean, is there any scenario where anyone passes audio across USB? It's digital.
It's always a digital thing.
And with digital, it's...
Digital.
It's digital. It either connects or it doesn't.
Yeah, so the only conceivable benefits might be good insulation, maybe, because sometimes on USB audio interfaces, you do get some weird electrical gubbins.
Yeah, just stick a toroidal...
Yeah, ferrite bead thing. Yeah. On it. Connectors, just something nice and durable, but they're all basically the same anyway. Yep, there we go. Done.
As I said, going back to the HDMI cables, you see the same thing. You go into these sort of stores and they've got these ridiculously priced HDMI cables hanging up, and they're all sort of got lovely braided exteriors and all this, and it's just going to languish at the back of your television or wherever you're plugging it. You know, you're just not going to see this stuff. As long as it's doing its job. And I mean, I'm not sure about the HDMI format. Again, it's digital, but
yeah,
surely there's some sort of error correction.
You would assume.
Especially over that sort of length. I mean, 1.5 metres, you say.
I found another one.
Do you think anyone is mug enough to buy that?
No, they can't be. But Wireworld have another one. This one is, I mean, they claim it's digital audio cable, but it's just RCA to RCA. I've splashed out. I've gone for the 3 meter variant.
Oh, what?
I assume they're not real connectors, but yeah.
Do you think people just sort of push this stuff out there and just think, well, you know,
we can make it, see if someone orders it?
Yeah. I mean, they just buying this stuff from China on the cheap or something in container loads.
Who knows? Who knows? Okay, ooh, here we go. I found the Wireworld website. These are the people responsible for such snake oil. Wireworld Cable Technology. They've got lots of pending patents, or patents, however you pronounce it.
So are they claiming to be the actual manufacturers of this stuff?
Potentially.
Mm.
About us. Oh no, they've already called themselves audiophiles, so you know it's bad. They started the 1980s. Interesting. When David realised the only way to discover what was being lost by a cable was to remove it altogether. So he unplugged his hi-fi and thought, that's better. I want that. Anyway, we've had some fun there. I don't know how we got onto this topic. We've rambled. We do like a rambly podcast. They're quite fun sometimes. A bit left field. But you know what we can do to bring this one home and wrap it up? I've actually come prepared this time. Of course, a miscellaneous multimedia recommendation. We need to make a jingle so it's nice and snappy, because our jingles are fun. Anyway, I've actually found some new music. Well, I say I have. Some was found for me by the composer John Wilson from Consciousness Productions, a UK-based band. I don't actually know where they're from because they don't have a wiki page. They're too small. Oh, yes. I got in there before they were big. So they're called Low Island. There is an album that I like called If You Could Have It All Again, which is the album cover's kind of a lake with a naked dude on a bit of wood. I don't know what's going on there, but it's really good so far. So it's actually captured my attention, which annoyingly I've been in about a year-long phase where I find it very difficult to actually be captured by properly new music, like new bands and things. A couple of recommendations for you. These are on YouTube. They've got some live versions, live from the Stone Room. Don't really know where that is, what that's about or anything. But two songs, Don't Let the Light In and Who's Having the Greatest Time. I would also suggest you listen to the album from the start up to Who's Having the Greatest Time, because that's a really good, I think, 5 or 6 song section. I'm really enjoying it, jamming it in the car all the time until I get sick of it. That's how I digest my new music. But no, it's cool. I haven't got through the whole album yet, but I think I like it. There we go. Low Island, the album is If You Could Have It All Again. And I'm a bit tempted to get it on vinyl, actually. Or get the CD as well, so I can actually listen to it in the car with good quality instead of using one of those stupid radio adapters. Anyway, Pete, what have you got for us to round off the podcast today?
Well, this week I've come across a great little travel channel on YouTube called Trax. It seems to feature programs that I can only assume were originally on UK terrestrial TV at one stage. I don't know particularly which channels they were on, but I have been enjoying a series which features on there called The World's Greatest Cities. And that is hosted by a gentleman called Griff Rhys-Jones. And for our listeners who are not in the UK, Griff Rhys-Jones is a comedian, writer and TV presenter. He first came to prominence in the late 70s on a comedy sketch show called Not the 9 o'clock News, which also featured a lady called Pamela Anderson and also Rowan Atkinson, which maybe some of our international viewers are familiar with. He is also known as Mr. Bean,
of course,
and also featured in the Blackadder comedy. And lately has been doing the
Johnny English
films. Yeah, I've been enjoying them. So these basically feature him going to London, Paris, New York, Hong Kong, etc. And the premise of the program, it sort of documents 24 hours in that city. Obviously, I'm sure they've filmed it over several days or maybe even weeks to get the content in, because it's quite detailed, and the various different facets of the program are very brief, but you know, your attention is kept. Again, it's easy watching. Griff Rhys-Jones is a charismatic presenter, and I find it works very well. So that would be my recommendation for this week. It's the travel channel called Trax on YouTube.
Lovely stuff. Well, listeners, thank you for tuning in as always, and got a bit of a teaser for you potentially. It is currently scheduled that episode 95 will have another one of our interviewee-type situation-y majigs. This time, I may actually prepare some questions properly. But stay tuned then for an interview with Ian O from Void Null. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll catch you in the next episode.